differentiated.
This gets differentiated. So this is a, this appears on the right-hand side. So this, because of the minus sign and the derivative, moves to the right-hand side. And so we have du bar t plus, perhaps I'm forgetting my one-halves here sometimes, but so you multiply this equation by u bar and integrate over space, and you get a this term drops out, and you get a term a ddt of u bar squared over 2 integrals over space equals, and then integrate by parts here, minus integral C delta squared du bar dx squared du bar dx. Okay, so this is this produces dissipation at every point proportional to the derivative of u cubed, the cube of du dx, and this also produces the right amount of dissipation in reason, because we've just used dimensional analysis to predict what it should look like, and sure enough, this thing is going to be proportional. This factor here will be proportional to delta u cubed over delta x cubed. And we have a delta squared times 1 over delta cubed. And then when we integrate over the width of each of these little shock things, we get another factor of delta x, because the width that these things are large is order delta. So this produces a term that looks like minus some constant times delta u cube at each of these little shock locations. Okay, and that's exactly what we want.
So you should identify grid mesh size with viscous, with shock width, when you get exactly the diffusive term, dissipative term that you throw.
Let's see.
Yes. So flux of energy is delta u of the delta du over dx.
You're saying keep this term.
No, in a sense, what I'm trying to understand is that probably what you did, you replaced small sizes with flux of energy which shoots from subgrid scale. So this term delta u squared over delta to the power 3 is approximately u prime squared multiplied by delta u over delta, which is exactly viscosity if delta is the size of the shock width.
Well, yeah, my viscosity is now this in some sense, right?
Exactly.
But that's much larger viscosity than the one I've ignored. Okay?
Well, if grid is of the same order.
Sure. No. My grid is much. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. So this was actually a scheme, a very similar scheme to this, was introduced by von Neumann and Rickmeyer. In 1949 for 1D gas dynamics. Okay. Okay, and then it was essentially the same idea, almost the same, for 3D. For turbulence, is accredited to Smagorinsky. I think it's 1963, I believe it is. And here, what you do is you consider not just let's call it the tau ij equals ui uj bar minus ui uj. You consider tau ij minus, you make tau ij trace free by taking the trace of tau and taking one third of that and using delta ij here. Now we have a traceless stress that we can now model with the what's equivalent to this the UDX, which what we use is a strain rate tensor. So we have an eddy viscosity times Sij. Okay, bar, Sij bar is 1/2 dui dxj plus duj dxi. Okay, and the turbulent viscosity or the eddy viscosity is just again delta squared times a constant times the norm of Sij. So it's very it's just a nice generalization of this idea here. And I don't know if some of you were there at Newton Institute last year, but Chuck Leith said that, first of all, Smagorinsky and von Neumann were both at Princeton in the early 60s, and Smagorinsky apparently told von Neumann that he was having trouble with his his simulations. Things were blowing up. And so apparently von Neumann told him to think about this idea and extend it to his calculation. So even von Neumann has some part in this model, apparently. This is what Chuck...
Oh, it's actually true.
Yeah, okay.
Well, normally, von Neumann tried to build a computer based on advanced study, actually. And he hired, and his chief problem that he wanted to do, the first problem that he wanted to do was weather prediction. And he hired Jules Charney.
Uh-huh.
And Jules Charney was giving you a problem of simulating weather on computers that you can hold in your hand now. Anyway, this was the problem in spades, how do you get rid of the small scales? And following this, they built an institute. After they kicked them out of the Institute of Advanced Study, kicked von Neumann and his computers out, and it was established at Princeton a geophysical fluid dynamics lab evolved from that, and Smagorinsky was head there. So it was a natural.
Well, this has been sort of a very workhorse model that's been used lots and lots. It does the job. But the problems are that CS, the Smagorinsky constant, seems to be somewhat flow dependent. a good Smigrinsky constants. And not only flow dependent, but dependent on time. If you have a time developing flow, such as a mixing layer, say, it turns out that you want less of a Smigrinsky constant early on, and you need a bigger Smigrinsky constant later on, and it becomes a problem how to justify that. So, also time and space dependent. And also, if you do a direct simulation of a flow field, take its compute this product and take the filter and subtract off this thing and subtract off this part and look at the correlation between this left-hand side and the right-hand side. It's very poor. It's really terrible. I'll show you some of that later. So poor correlation. Poor correlation with the actual round stress, a subgrid stress. But a nice improvement came along in about 1990. That allowed, so 1990 or so, Germano found a really nice little identity that you can use to estimate the Smigrinsky constant on the fly. So this estimation can be used, to find space and time dependent Smigrinsky constants. And the idea is to filter at one level. So, let me change notations just for this discussion because it gets complicated. Let me call a filter at the F level to be integral g of f u, and a filter at the g level, integral g of g u. And since these are typically independent, depend on the difference between x and x prime. A filter at the FG level would be just the filter G of G convolved with G of F times U. So if you'd rather think in the Fourier world, then it's just this is just multiplication by G hat U. G hat times U hat, G hat times U hat, G of F hat, G of G hat. So this would just be the product in Fourier space. So Germano said, okay, let's just consider tau at the F level. So what is that? That's UI, UJ, F minus U I U J all at F. And he said, okay, what happens if we now also do filter this whole equation at the G level? So we get tau of F filtered at the G level, and that's going to be this double product FG minus UIF UIGF Okay, and we can also construct tau FG by just using this filter as a single filter and looking at tau FG. So that's tau FG, just this. Okay, and then we can do one other thing, and I forgot what it is.
What is the broadest filter here?
What?
What is the broadest filter here?
Which is the broadest one?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't said, have I? I think, I don't think it matters until we get to the end. I believe... He thinks of it in terms of, well, I know what it is. Just the next thing you can do is take the F filtered field and just do a G Reynolds stress on that. So that would be what you call tau G of UF. So you can pretend that you're, this is F. You can pretend that so F is some kind of filter that you're using all the time. And G is an extra filter that you bring in to do this calculation. You don't use it. But I still haven't told you the relative widths of these things, and I think that's just, you play with that. And it's for sure that this is more heavily filtered than either one of these. I mean, that's all you need for this result. So you can write this out, and this is UIF UJF product of that. Filtered on the G scale minus UI FG UJ FG. And what Germano noticed was if you take these three equations and combine them, you can eliminate this term by subtracting this equation from this, and you can eliminate this term by subtracting this equation from this, and some of these things drop out also. So what happens is you get the following result: tau FG equals the tau F averaged over G. Plus tau G of the resolved field UI F UJF. Okay, this is known as Germano's identity. And why is it useful? It's not so useful, just right off the bat, because you don't know this guy or this guy. But you do know this, because this is a filtered velocity field that you're presumably computing, and you can always compute its subgrid stress assuming another filtering operation takes place on this field. So this is okay. So how do you use this? Well, you use this by plugging in the Smagorinsky model into these two terms. And you can solve for the Smagorinsky constant. So that's the idea. There's one problem that you have to worry about right away, and that is this is a function of I and J. So Smagoritsky constant is a function of I, J, X, and T. So what you do is you contract this equation using Sij or just something reasonable, and that gets rid of this. And so you're left with an equation for the Smagoritsky constant, which is a function of X and T. And they tried this out in the early 90s, and it doesn't work very well unless you average over fairly large domains to get rid of the fluctuations, because this guy's going negative in lots of places. And so
that's
a good point. Let me get to that. So anyway, this is called the dynamic Smagoritsky model.
Could you clarify just the dimensionality of things in the formula? The left-hand side is like u squared, it's tau.
Yeah.
The right-hand side, is that tau a function of u, I, u,
this is, this, this just means tau of a function of this field, yeah. It's not times. I show the arguments here, and I didn't show the arguments here, but.
So it might happen in real world that the tensorial structures are going to be different. So you have to contract the synthesis in order to get. So is it possible to write down the most general tensor in U and G and then define several Smagoritsky constants?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you could. So you're saying. Use this idea, but use a more. I think that's a good point, and I don't. Maybe some other people know of these efforts, but lots of things have been tried, and I'm not always up to date on exactly which ones have been successful. Yeah, there's a big. Okay. This has been a favorite now for 8 or 9 years, but it still has a lot of problems. And Ellen asked, what about dissipation? It turns out that from actual applications, it seems to be a disaster if C of S goes negative anywhere. So they just clip it to zero if they have to. So, but if this is positive, then it's definitely dissipative, okay? If it's zero, then nothing happens. So, okay. So it still has you have a lot of ad hoc procedures associated with the method, although you can it seems to do a little bit better. It does better than the standard Smagoritsky because it has more flexibility, but it still has this problem.
So what does the flexibility do? It's an algorithm for how to change the constant in such a way as to be sensitive to the flow properties.
Yeah, for example, if you're doing a flow next to a wall and you use, instead of using a space-dependent function here. You average this equation over layers parallel to the wall. What happens is there's very little activity near the wall, so that C of S goes to zero. But that's exactly turns out to be exactly what you wanted to do.
So would you say that you need to know something about your flow in advance in order to for this to be useful?
Yeah, you would. Yeah.
It's essentially a higher form of curve theory.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of the things I wanted to say was that the original Smagoritsky model fails for a phenomenon called backscatter. I don't know if you're going to talk about
that. Yeah, I'm going to talk about backscatter, yeah.
And this may have or may not have this backscatter.
Yeah, it does have the possibility of backscatter, but apparently it's too much backscatter because of this assumption. You're talking about an eddy viscosity that goes negative, and that's really apparent. That Even if it happens locally, that can be a real disaster. Yeah.
What about the Burgers equation? How does this model perform in the Burgers equation?
I don't know. The Burgers equation.
Two-dimensional Burgers equation.
I think the 1D Burgers equation is probably works pretty well with a single constant. I don't know.
Yeah. We see the mean. So when the mean decreases, then it just goes exactly to some stabilization equation.
Does it? Yeah. So the Smigolinsky constant does not become negative in for the one-dimensional Burgers equation. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's no. Let's see. I haven't thought through what happens if you just put in a 1D example here. You'd have to really plug in a flow field and see what happens to this equation. You're talking about using this idea on, I don't know, have you seen that done? It's possible somebody tried that. And
But how does non-adaptive scheme work for Burgers equation?
It produces things that look like this. I meant to mention that. It produces things with just a little bit of stuff on them. It's really hard to get rid of this kind of stuff.
You can relate that to a mixing lens, so-called.
Yeah.
And you could think of that as the first term in expansion, in which there are second derivatives and third derivatives, and uncommon actually did that. Mm-hmm.
It can be made into a systematic equation, the expansion, and it improves as you decrease the group factor.
I don't know. There are ways to make it more legitimate, but that's usually when the small, very small scale turbulence is causing the subgrid motions. I think.
One of the answers to your question would be that the higher order moments of the structure function, what are they? And I don't know the answer to that. But that would be a good question to look at.
And another question. In the very first sketch that you made, which I think is extremely important, you suggested, of course, that one was really aiming at a smooth version of the real flow, which would then coincide with the real flow, at least in phase.
No,
amplitude.
Sorry, yeah, that
and
was
so
a...
A measure of that would be, for example, the statistics of the variations on a certain scale, whether that property is, for example, reflected correctly in any model.
I forgot to mention that I'm not trying to get the. This is not a predictive thing. This is just an indication. We're not trying to do weather prediction. We're just trying to get statistics right. So it's more like a climate.
Yeah, the question is, which statistics can one possibly get right, and which one can one not get right? For example, it's possible that you have. In the real model, a certain distribution of jumps.
Yeah.
In the Burgers equation, for example, but then the model actually gives you too many jumps that are close to the maximum possible value, and in that way reflects the wrong statistics.
Well, in my view, you would like to reproduce things like the filtered energy spectrum roughly correctly, because that's that's kind of a spatial average quantity, or you'd like to get the decay rate of a turbulence decay problem about right. You'd like to get mean profiles in, say, channel flow or in a pipe. You'd like to get mean flow about right. And then any time average statistics, or if you want to be greedy, you'd like to get more and more statistics right. But exact time evolutions, of course, you don't need them. There's another. Let me just briefly mention some other ideas that are not strictly dissipative and then have backscatter that Norm was mentioning. So other models? And just to speed up a little bit, I want to show you one that I've been involved in. There are several out there. This one is based on the idea that if you use a Gaussian filter to do the filtering, so here's a, just for simplicity, we start out in one dimension, and we have the product U times V filtered with a Gaussian filter. Now you can actually expand this guy out and get this, presumably get a closure for this product. But of course, it involves a lot of detailed information that there's no way you can actually get reliable information on. And so this is in the, if we try to use this idea, this is sort of in the direction of trying to deconvolve the filtered field. So in a sense, it's trying to say, okay, I've got U bar and V bar. Let me try to estimate U and V from that, multiply U and V together, and take the filter of that. And so this is in that direction. And if you use just the first two terms, and D dimensions, you get this result. And this is very much related to other methods that are out there that are kind of similar. There's scale similarity method, Klaus Adams at ETH is looking at approximate deconvolution, Bernard Gertz at Twente inverse modeling, and Domorodsky is looking at so-called estimation of subgrid scales. And just to show you what happens if you use this idea, on the scalar convection diffusion equation, this term here, UI psi is the scalar density, bar is UI bar, psi bar, and then the first term produces this result here, and then we're neglecting all this stuff. So this second term, the first term comes over here and becomes this. The second term comes over here and gives you this kind of strange looking diffusivity. It's just the diffusivity given by this tensor, the strain rate tensor. And you might imagine that this would might have some value because it could happen, for example, that we have a very smooth velocity field but a fairly complicated scalar field. So you might imagine, well, maybe this is a lot smaller than that because the velocity field is very, very smooth. And in fact, this does produce exact results if the velocity field is just purely a straining field, uniformly straining. Okay, and that's, so you're supposed to compare this term with kind of a Smagorinsky type model that you might use instead of that. But this has some interesting properties. I don't know if Norm remembers, I talked about it at your big celebration. if you go into principal coordinates, that diffusion term has some negative directions of negative diffusion. So in particular, if you go into principal coordinates of Sij, the eigenvalues of Sij are alpha, beta, and gamma for incompressible flow. They sum to zero. So you have to have some positive eigenvalues, or they're all zero. And so in particular, this would be the one direction, the one prime direction would be have negative diffusion. And that's the direction of stretching of material coordinates. So there's backscatter, definite backscatter. And the and if you apply the same idea to Navier-Stokes, again, you get this. The second term produces, again, a tensor diffusivity. And now you can look at the energy loss or gain rate due to this term. And at any particular point, it's going to be forward scattering or backward scattering, depending on the sign of this term, or actually an earlier version of that. But if you average over the whole flow, you can relate this term to the skewness of the velocity derivative times these factors here. And if you use standard decay of isotropic turbulence results, you find that this energy loss rate is proportional to the actual energy loss rate that you want times the skewness of the velocity derivative, which is about 0.4 to 0.6. So this term does produce net energy loss, but if you'd use it all by itself, and just it doesn't do a very good job. In fact, it does a terrible job. So if you but if you add a dynamic Smagorinsky to this, you know, things are looking a lot better, and people. And these are so-called mixed models. When you have two different kinds of subgrid models and you add them together, and these mixed models have a fair amount of success. And this, so that together, this one's purely dissipative, but this one is not, and so you have some backscatter and. And so that's the way things are going, getting a little bit more and more complicated. And I don't want to keep everybody too long, but oh yeah, this is what happens. Beru and Orszag also looked at this tensor diffusivity model. And they were looking at the correlation between the actual subgrid stress and the one given by the model. And the tensor eddy diffusivity model is a correlation coefficient of about 0.9. So it's doing a fairly good job, whereas the Smagorinsky model just really has hardly any correlation between the actual stress and the model stress.
For what model is this? Some kind of vortex flow or something?
This is just isotropic turbulence. This is so you compute the turbulence in the box with high resolution numerical methods, and then you filter those, and so you can exactly compute the subgrid stress for those results, and compare them with what you would get if you had a model that tried to predict what the subgrid stress is. This is not necessarily a very good, meaningful test, because sometimes you don't even care. I mean, just because this looks bad, it still could provide about the right result. But it's an indication that the model has really hardly anything to do with physics in this model. So just, and one of the things that hydro people are working on is boundary layer turbulence. And this is an old calculation of Spillart done of simulation, direct full simulation of boundary layer turbulence. And this is the vorticity. The flow is going this way. This is kind of the layer, boundary layer of turbulent motion. This is the wall down here. And this is relatively low Reynolds number. The problem with trying to do boundary layer turbulence is that the small scales of motion near the wall are very small, and there are no large scales that are very important. And so if you do large eddy simulation, you'd like to have at least a population of large eddies. Well, there's no population of large eddies, so to get large eddies, you have to have a mesh that gets extremely small near the wall to pick up at least some eddy motions, and that kills you. So there's a big effort to try to avoid that and do large eddy simulation of boundary layer flows without any large eddies. So that, except, you know, there are large eddies up here, but there aren't any ones down here. So I forgot lots of things, but let me just finish there and take some comments or questions. I was going to try to talk to Nick before this, but I came by your office yesterday since you're doing this kind of work, right?
No, I do tonight.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I'd like to make a comment.
Oh, please.
Well, one of the things that happens is that I've noticed is that you develop a model, say, for the ancient of all problems, the flat plate boundary layer, and you get it to work. When you make a perturbation in a problem, like you make the boundary layer drop off to another boundary layer, or you put a little cavity in the flow, or something like that, it doesn't work at all anymore.
That's for Reynolds stress modeling, you mean, or?
Yeah, in general.
Yeah. That, you're right.
As soon as you put in some aspect, shear layer develops in the flow, you know, a drop in the boundary, and the curve is too much, you're not going to calculate the vorticity properly at the small scale. So in those regions where the vorticity at the small scale is important, you're just not getting it.
Oh, I forgot to mention, Sergei Nazarenko just spent about a half hour explaining his kind of elegant technique to do 2D turbulence with a subgrid model. It's you should talk to him if you're interested. It's really nice. He's got a population of eddies that he keeps track of on the subgrid scale, and then using rapid distortion theory, I guess, and it computes the feedback of that population of subgrid eddies on the mean on the large scale flow. It's quite nice.
Could you hear more of that then?
Pardon?
Could you hear more of that?
If you could talk him into it, yeah. Yeah.
I don't really understand the philosophy, because here the requirement on Reynolds, what's being modeled there is not the subgrid, but the problem with the large air coefficient. I mean, it's not attempting to model the correlation. You don't know what's happening on the subgrid dynamically. I don't really see how you can attempt to. By definition, it's not a continuation of the larger scale.
The in the RIP, you're talking about the von Neumann case, or what?
I'm just saying that this is not attempting to really model subgrid. What it's doing is it's mocking up a viscosity. It's another term in the equation, and that's what it looks like.
Yeah, but formally, it's trying to model this term. And in a sense, the subgrid scale contributions are, if you, I can write it, perhaps U squared bar is U bar plus 2 U bar U prime bar plus U prime squared bar. Now you can see more easily that you could take this part out of here, and this is exactly computable, but these guys are still what I would call subgrid components of this, which you have to model. And so the model is to make things dissipative. That's where you lose sight of the physics, I think. Just make a model that's dissipative. But you can see that this, the left-hand side has to do directly with subgrid motions. I mean, okay, yeah.
Two things. One, there's a thing to find out for dinner floating around. is it obvious that these subgrid motions only produce some sort of diffusion?
Only produce what?
Some sort of diffusion.
The ones I talked about early, the Smagorinsky and von Neumann Rickmeyer, produce dissipation.
Yeah.
Diffusion of momentum. The others have backscatter in them. So they have both. Here's another thing. One more point, sorry. If you know exactly what the structure is underneath, this is tensor diffusivity model now applied back to the Berger's equation. If you take the tensor diffusivity model and apply it, go back to the Berger's equation, you can actually modify this term by some trick that knows the structure of this function. And what happens is that you get an effective subgrid scale stress that is rises much more steeply than the von Neumann-Rickmeyer result, which is only linear in dudx. This exact function rises much faster and then levels off. So there's a lesson here that if you know exactly what kind of thing is underneath all this, you can actually construct models that can give you the right subgrid scale stress. But so here's a case where we know the structure of the function, and so we can construct these subgrid models. And this is just an example. Now, on the other hand, this is not very numerically very friendly, and so you have to play all kinds of tricks to get this thing to work. But at least on paper, this is the right answer. Now, I don't know if that helps your question, but. That was related anyway, I thought.
You have this plot where you compare the correlation of the two scales. Wasn't all the details. What are the two quantities? How do you define the two quantities? So on the lower corner is that backscatter already, right?
Okay, I'm taking...
The left corner. What exactly is the quantity?
I'm looking at one of the components, IJ component of tau.
Right, but it's too many components, six components.
Yeah, and I think they just used all the off-diagonal ones, I believe, are just... So you... So one of them is the exact... So this would be the exact result. And this would be the model result, and you just take the at one point in the flow, and you put a point there, right?
It's really just one component.
Yeah.
One of the three off-diagonal.
Yeah.
Components.
Yeah.
And the diagonal components, they are better? Yeah, okay.
Well, the diagonal components don't come out directly in this, because this, it's hard to estimate the diagonal components because you subtract off their mean and put it into the pressure. So it's not really fair to do that. And you don't care that much about it anyway. Mm-hmm. Well.
Except for growers.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're doing a comparison like this, how do you know you're operating the same effective Reynolds number?
Oh, this is...
So for the model, in other words, how do you estimate the effective Reynolds number of that model?
The model doesn't care what the Reynolds number is. It just looks at the strain rate tensor and constructs everything from that and the delta squared.
Well, one thing you would have to tell us is how the delta of the model compares to the delta of the simulation. The true simulation to which it's compared, and then you can obviously choose the model very far away, and then it just falls apart, right? I mean,
yeah.
There's that essence of it.
Yeah.
It's not just a factor of two.
Yeah.
The idea is to make it more. And the question is, how fast does the model fall apart as you move the model away from the true cutoff? In other words, the Kolmogorov-Levy scale of the
I understand.
And delta.
Yeah.
There, you can separate them by quite a lot.
Yeah.
As you separate them more and more, the model falls apart.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't have those numbers.
Is there any method that keeps track of time correlation?
Time correlation of what?
Any of these.
Oh, I see. No, I don't know of any.
Because when you take some finite time step, or finite image spacing as well.
Oh, I see. Yeah, you can. You're right. You can actually filter in time too, because presumably you're not picking up all the rapid motions that are possible by your method. So there's a formalism where you include time as a something that gets filtered. Also, is that what you're talking about? Yeah. Yeah. You can do that. I don't know if it buys you anything extra. Yeah.